Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Narom Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam. Tato jayam udhirayet nasta praishu abhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati uttamasloke bhaktir bhavati naishtiki. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 19, The Perfection of Spiritual Knowledge. Verse 17. Are you guys able to stay for the whole class? You have to leave? What time? You have to leave in 5 minutes. Okay. Sruti pratyaksham aitikyam anumanam chatushtayam pramaneshvanavastanat vikalpatsa virajyate. Sruti pratyaksham aitikyam anumanam chatushtayam pramaneshvanavastanat vikalpatsa virajyate. Sruti pratyaksham aitihyam anumanam chatushtayam pramaneshvanavastanat vikalpatsa virajyate. Sruti pratyaksham aitihyam anumanam chatushtayam pramaneshvanavastanat vikalpatsa virajyate. Shruti pratyaksham aitihyam anumanam chatushtayam pramaneshvanavastanat vikalpatsa virajyate. Sruti pratyaksham aitichyam anumanam chatushtayam pramaneshvanavastanat vikalpatsa virajyate. Sruti Sruti pratyaksham aitihyam Hanumanam chatushtayam Pramaneshvana vastanat Vikalpatsa virajyate. Yovana, you want to chant? No? Okay. I'm going to go right to the verse and skip the word for word because you guys have to leave and at least you could hear the translation, right? From the four types of evidence, Vedic knowledge, direct experience, traditional wisdom, and logical induction, one can understand the temporary, insubstantial situation of the material world, by which one becomes detached from the duality of this world. Please repeat. From the four types of evidence, Vedic knowledge, direct experience, traditional wisdom, and logical induction, one can understand the temporary, insubstantial situation of the material world, by which one becomes detached from the duality of this world. I was just reading a short while ago where it was said that when Srila Prabhupada first came here, he knew that, you know, quoting the Shastras wouldn't be very effective. In India, the Shastras is the ultimate authority. Nobody argues against the Shastra. You have to argue based on what the Shastra says. But nobody can say anything. If you are quoting Shastra as evidence, nobody can say anything in India. But here, nobody knows anything about Shastra. So you could quote Shastra all day long, and it's not. So Srila Prabhupada realized that when he came. So he used logical induction a lot. He spoke logically. He presented things in a logical way that people could understand them. And he also quoted the Shastra, but it wasn't his main way of convincing people. He quoted the Shastra because Shastra always has to be quoted. And he also was teaching his students gradually, you know, to understand properly. And, you know, the authority, the basis had to be there. So he quoted Shastra, but it wasn't his main way of convincing people. So, purport. In the Shruti, or Vedic literature, it is clearly stated that everything emanates from the Absolute Truth, is maintained by the Absolute Truth, and at the end is conserved within the Absolute Truth. Similarly, by direct experience, we can observe the creation and destruction of great empires, cities, buildings, bodies, and so on. Furthermore, we find all around the world traditional wisdom, warning people that things in this world cannot last. Finally, by logical induction, we can easily conclude that nothing in this world is permanent. Material sense gratification, up to the highest possible living standard found in the heavenly planets, or down to the lowest conditions in the most repugnant precincts of hell, is always unsteady and prone to collapse at any moment. One should therefore develop vairagya, detachment, as stated here. Another meaning of this verse is that four types of evidence cited here are often mutually contradictory in their description of the highest truth. One should therefore be detached from the duality of mundane evidence, including the portions of the Vedas that deal with the material world. Instead, one should accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the actual authority. Both in Bhagavad Gita and here in Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Krishna is personally speaking, and thus there is no need to enter into the bewildering network of competing systems of mundane logic. One can directly hear from the Absolute Truth himself and immediately acquire perfect knowledge. One thereby becomes detached from inferior systems of knowledge, which cause one to hover on the material mental platform. Hari Bol, have a good day at school. Are you going to school? Okay. Om Agyanati Mirandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshushal Unmilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Tamal Krishna Goswami Niti Namine Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Prachardine Nirvesesha Shunnavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. From the four types of evidence, Vedic knowledge, direct experience, traditional wisdom, and logical induction, one can understand the temporary, insubstantial situation of the material world, by which one becomes detached from the duality of this world. So this verse reminds me of a story that the devotees told me when I first came to the temple. They told me this story about a person who was on the bank of a lake or a river. And on the other side, there were many people. And they were just having a wonderful time. And they were so happy. And, they were dancing and singing. They just looked like they were completely free from any anxieties. And me and the other person on the other side of the river was full of anxieties, just full of anxieties, suffering terribly and looking for a way, to become free from his suffering. So the people that looked so happy and free from anxiety on the other side, they were inviting him to come across the river and join them, and then he could also be free from all anxiety. Problem was, he had this big bag of rocks. And he carried them everywhere he went, and he had them for such a long time, and so he was attached to them, to his bag of rocks. And so they were trying to encourage him. Look, all you have to do is get rid of the rocks. They don't have no real value. Just leave them aside, and then you can cross the river and join us. So this was his problem. On one hand, he could, you know, see that he wanted to cross the river and join them, but he was really attached to his rocks. And anyway, so, you know, the moral of the story is you simply give up these attachments to these inferior rocks, and then you can go and join these happy people on the other side of the river. Simply cross the river. So they told me this story, and I thought, wow, what a great story. It just, you know, it made such perfect sense. And, you know, really explained things in such a simple way, you know, that you could really understand it and see it, that, man, all these people are suffering like anything. I'm suffering like anything. All we have to do is give up these rocks and join, you know, the devotees. It made such perfect sense, and I could relate to it so well. So I did that. I got rid of my rocks, and I joined the devotees. And, you know, for me, it was a pretty dramatic, thing also. I mean, it is for everybody that you know, joins the Hare Krishna movement. But for me, it was particularly like a dramatic thing because, you know, I was young, only about 19 years old. I was married already and had a baby daughter. She was around 1 year old at the time. And, you know, I was like a typical hippie, and, you know, none of these things were planned. They just all kind of happened. And so the thing was, you know, my wife didn't really want to become a devotee. She didn't see it. The way I saw it, you know, she didn't want to drop her bag of rocks at all. So, you know, over a period of time, and it came to the point where, you know, I had to leave her to become a devotee. And in those days, you know, that kind of thing was encouraged. And so, you know, I had a particularly big bag of rocks. I mean, you know, a wife and a daughter and a job and, you know, a family, you know, extended family members, everything, you know. And they tried everything to convince me, you know, not to do it. But I was determined to, you know, drop that bag of rocks and join the devotees. So I did that. And even my name, Mahahari Das, was awarded to me by my spiritual master because of that. You know, Maha means great, and Hari means the Lord who helps the conditioned soul to overcome all obstacles, you know, in coming to his lotus feet. So that name was actually given to me because I had to overcome so many obstacles to become a devotee. So anyway, you know, I dropped this bag of rocks and I joined the devotees, and I also became happy. I became, you know, so happy for about the first 3-4 years. I was basically liberated. It was exciting. I was having a wonderful time. I was, you know, free from all anxieties and, you know, so many wonderful things happening. And so, you know, that lasted for about the first 3 or 4 years. And then something started to happen. I dropped my bag of rocks, or at least I thought I did, and I crossed the river, right? Well, then I started to I started to gasp, and, I started to drown, I started drowning in the water, and, water started going up my nose, and, I started having all this difficulty. And I'm wondering, what happened? I dropped my bag of rocks. But then as I started to look, I realized, wow, I didn't drop all those rocks. I only dropped a little bit of them. I got more rocks everywhere, stashed in my pockets, everywhere. And so I realized, it wasn't quite as simple as that that example seemed to make it when I first heard it. There's actually more to it. Basically, of course, everyone is different, but a lot of us, when we first become devotees, we become fully convinced on one level. And usually this level is a intellectual level. Our intellect, our intelligence becomes fully convinced. It just makes such perfect sense. And, by that, we decide to become devotees. And this is no small thing. This is a huge thing. This is a big thing. And, people change their lives just drastically. At that point, their sojourn in the material world is ending, and really, what happens at that point is just an amazing thing. One associates with the devotees, one starts to follow all the practices, one takes initiation from a bona fide spiritual master. One begins the process of anartha. And really, what happens when one does that, when one takes initiation and surrenders to a bona fide spiritual master, is an absolutely amazing thing. What happens is Krishna clears the slate, and you become completely freed from past sinful reactions. And it's absolutely an amazing thing. Actually, this has to happen for one to take up devotional service in earnest. One has to become free from sinful reactions. And that's what happens when one takes initiation from a bona fide spiritual master. His path is cleared. All those obstacles of sinful reactions from past sins are actually taken away. And what happens at that point, his path just becomes clear before him. Now, what he does later, will determine really if the path stays clear. But at that point, it all becomes clear. And so this is, this is no small thing. This is a big thing. But really, for most of us, that conviction that I am, Krishna's eternal servant, Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead, he's Bhoktaram Jagyatapasam Sarvaloka Maheshwaram Suridam Sarvabhutanam Gatvamam Shantim Richati. He's the owner, the proprietor and maintainer of all worlds, of all creation. He's the beneficiary of all sacrifices that anyone performs. They're done for his benefit. Even if they don't know it, they're done for his benefit. And he is the most dear friend of all, living entities. So, You know, we become convinced of all this on the intellectual level. And that's really what this verse here is describing. From the four types of evidence, Vedic knowledge, direct experience, traditional wisdom, and logical induction, one can understand the temporary, insubstantial situation of the material world, by which one becomes detached from the duality of this world. So that's basically what this is describing, that we become intellectually convinced on one level, and we get detachment from that, so much detachment that we're able to completely change our lives, and devotees change their lives in amazing ways, you know, to actually surrender take up the process of devotional service. But thing is, we have different levels. We don't just have the intellectual level. We have many, many different levels. And for us to progress in the path of devotional service, we have to become convinced on all these different levels, much, much deeper than just the intellectual level. Deeper than the intellectual level is the emotional level. What actually causes me to feel real emotions? This is much deeper than the intellectual level. You may become convinced of something intellectually, but when it comes to things that you're really emotional about, you're not going to act on the intellectual level. You're going to act on that emotional level. You know, a mother, she may know that her son is doing something wrong and he's doing some really bad things. But if you come to that mother and say, and complain about her son and say, your son's doing this and he's doing, you know, she's going to protect her son. Doesn't matter. She knows he's doing this or that. Those emotions are going to take over. And that's human nature. You can't artificially repress those things. So we have many different levels and they all have to become convinced for us to fully take shelter of and become real devotees. So that goes, you know, way beyond what's being described in this verse here. It's a great thing, but at the same time, it's not everything. There's more to be. And it's wonderful how in the purport, two understandings of this verse are presented. Perhaps the second one is more important. And maybe I'll just read it again. Another meaning of this verse is that four types of evidence cited here are often mutually contradictory in the description of the highest truth. One should therefore be detached from the duality of mundane evidence. So we have to go beyond this mundane evidence, including the portions of the Vedas that deal with the material world. Instead, one should accept the Supreme Personality of God as the actual authority. Both in Bhagavad Gita and here in Srimad Bhagavatam, Lord Krishna is personally speaking. And thus there is no need to enter into the bewildering network of competing systems of mundane logic. I remember once I was giving a class in Houston. It was a Sunday feast class. And I had read something before that got me kind of inspired to speak on a particular topic. You know, when there's a large Indian audience at a Sunday feast or any program, you know, a very popular topic for people to speak about is demigod worship. You always hear that, you know. So I got inspired by something I read. I think it was actually Krishna book, the story about Rukmini becoming, rescued by Lord Krishna. Just such a wonderful story. And, it describes how Rukmini wrote this letter and confidentially sent it to Lord Krishna through a trusted Brahmin. And it's just an amazing story. And so The whole plan was that the perfect time to rescue Rukmini would have been that before the marriage, her family's custom was that they would go and visit the temple just before the marriage and offer worship to the presiding deity at the temple. Now, that temple, I think it was a Durga temple. Pretty sure it was Durga, was the family deity. And, you know, this is Rukmini, so she's worshiping demigods, you know. And we often speak against demigod worship. Lord Krishna, we quote the verses in Bhagavad Gita where Lord Krishna says, less intelligent people worship the demigods, you know. But anyway, so then Srila Prabhupada goes on to explain this, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with the practice of deity worship. It's the actual misunderstandings that people have in Kali Yuga about it that are bad, not worshiping demigods. That's not bad. Thinking that, you know, demigods are the same as Krishna, that's bad. You know, and those kind of misconceptions become prevalent in Kali Yuga, but not in previous times. So anyway, I got inspired to speak about this topic, and I was speaking about it. And I thought I was presenting it in a kind of a fair and balanced way, you know. And anyway, at the end of the class, one man raised a kind of an objection or a question. And, you know, you could also sense when he when he asked the question, that he was, experienced some frustration. You know, like he had heard these things many, many times, and, you know. He said that in the Shastras, the Vedas, he said that in the Vedas, where it describes this demigod worship, it is said that by worshiping, and I forget, you know, any particular demigod he mentioned, but by worshiping Durga or worshiping this demigod or that, one receives liberation and goes back to the spiritual world. He said, "Is that that's actually said there?" You know, and he said it with a certain amount of frustration, and I have to admit, when he said that, I got to be a little bit confused. I think, well, it actually says that. And I'm sure it does, although I'm not familiar with the, obviously those sections of the Vedas where these things are said. So that's what's really being presented here, that one has to go beyond, and that's a famous verse in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Don't be confused by the flowery language of the Vedas. You know, one has to understand the truth in a very honest way. One has to submit himself to the perfect authorities so that he can actually understand the truth progressively. What we understand as truth today won't necessarily be what we understand as truth a year from now. We're progressing. And if one, you know, clings to his false ego and his conceptions and ideas of what he thinks is right and wrong, and is not open to the truth which is being given to us by Lord Krishna, and specifically through his representatives, then one will misunderstand. He'll get caught up in these different ideas. The Vedas give instructions, you know, for everyone, whatever level he's at. So, of course, these people that are at that level where they need to worship, they're extremely materially attached, extremely attached to, you know, gathering wealth and aristocratic, you know, family members and, you know, all these things. You know, the demigod worship is meant for them. But it's given as a way to come to a higher level. It's not given as the all in all. It is supposed to bring one to the point of detachment. You know, gradually, by this process of karmakandya, one thing that happens is he associates with saintly persons. He has to perform the sacrifices and, you know, giving in charity and all these things. He must associate with elevated Brahmins to do it properly. So he gets the association of saintly persons, and he gradually hears from them. And also, you know, he becomes frustrated. The amazing thing that the Beatles said, especially George Harrison, you know, they started out as just, you know, paupers, nobodies, nothings, in a bad part, you know, living and growing up in a bad part of London. And then they became the Beatles. And when they became the Beatles, the fame and wealth and everything that they got was practically on the level of a demigod. For them just to walk out the door to go anywhere, they'd have to have 20 security guards just to walk out the front door. What would happen was just astounding. Even if you compare it with what you could find today, practically nothing on the level of the Beatles' fame and wealth. And so amazing thing they said was that, you know, they went from nothing to being practically on the level of a demigod, and, you know, they could do anything they wanted. There's nothing that they could not do. They had a desire, they could fulfill it. They had the facility to do that. Even like most of these famous entertainers, these rock and roll musicians or whatever, musicians, they have to go on tour. You know, they can't just sit there and make records. They have to go out and promote those. They have to make public appearances. That means they have to travel all over the world, you know, and it's really, really difficult to be on the road and, you know, and go to all, you know, appearances at all these really, really difficult. But they have to do it. But the Beatles were so famous and wealthy that they didn't even have to do that. They just said at one point, we're not going to do that anymore. And they could sit in their home and their recording studio and just make records. That's how famous and how influential they were, you know. So they said that after we attained all this, we realized that it doesn't equal happiness. Such an amazing thing to get everything that you could possibly want and then to realize it has nothing to do with happiness. You know, the Karmakandiya section of the Vedas is meant to bring one to this realization that you could get, you know, from the performing these different sacrifices and rituals and sacrifices, you can get enjoyment on the level of the demigods, but it simply does not equal happiness. It will always come to frustration. So at that point, one's ready for the process of gyan. So anyway, these different processes are meant to gradually bring one to higher and higher levels. So anyway, let's see, it's 8:18. So another thing that could be understood from this verse is that this process of becoming detached And then, you know, going on to, you know, higher levels gradually like that, it's not actually what's recommended or what's, you know, being taught to us, you know, specifically for the Kali Yuga, for this particular, you know, the particular time and circumstances. Actually, what we're being taught to do and what we're trying to convince, you know, others to do in our preaching activity is to forego all that and take directly to the process of devotional service. And it's kind of an amazing thing when you think about it, and specifically when you experience taking up the process, because here it is Kali Yuga, and people in this age have no good qualities. They lack sufficient intelligence. You know, they, just so many difficulties are there because of the terrible sinful activities that people engage in this age and that we've engaged in the past. But here, we're being told to forego all these different processes and take directly to the path of devotional service. Now, in previous ages, that wasn't like that. You know, they were more told to take up different indirect processes to help them gradually come to the direct process of direct devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they had, so in previous ages, they had better qualities, less sinful activity, more religiosity, and they were told, you know, to take, are oftentimes told to take to the indirect processes of gyan or yoga or karmakanda to gradually bring them to the. And here in this age, we have less good qualities, and we're being told to. So it's an amazing thing when you actually think about it. And of course, the reason is one thing, and that's. I wish I could remember the verse in the Bhagavatam, but where Shukadeva Goswami says that, you know, the Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults, but there is one good thing about Kali Yuga, and that is that simply by congregational chanting of the holy names, one can attain everything. Everything that one could attain through 10,000 years of, you know, meditation and yoga, everything that one could attain by the amazing, you know, sacrifices that they would perform, especially in the time of Lord Ramachandra, all the munis and sages, they were engaged in the process of offering sacrifice to Lord Vishnu. And that was Treta Yuga, right? And then, you know, the deity worship, we still see remnants of amazing temples and especially in India and also other parts of the world too, where, you know, fabulous deity worship was performed. Everything that one can attain from all those processes in the Kali Yuga can be attained simply by the process of congregational chanting of the holy names, Sankirtan. So anyway, I think maybe I could stop here. Anyone have any? Yeah, yes, Prabhu.
You mentioned about what is not happiness. I came in late. Maybe you already gave the answer. But can you tell us what is happiness today?
Oh, what is happiness? Okay, well, yeah, I heard something really interesting from His Holiness Giriraj Swami. So, of course, there are different types of happiness, right? There's happiness on the material level, like the mode of goodness. And then there's spiritual happiness also, right? Happiness on the platform of the soul. So Giriraj Swami was speaking to some college students. And he spoke about, you know, his time as a student in a famous university in, you know, the Northeast. I'm not sure which university it was, in Boston, a famous university there. And he was studying psychology. And his professors were some of the most famous psychologists in all of, you know, the Western world, or in, you know, this part of the world, psychology. There were some of the most progressive, famous psychologists, you know, at least at that time. And some of them had done a study for which they were very famous for, and books were wrote about it. They did a study on happiness. A very, very elaborate study. And they proved by their research and their, you know, by their research and all the studies that something like 97 or 98% of what everyone does in the world, or at least in this country, in the pursuit of happiness does not bring happiness at all. They proved this by logic and research and, you know, not by the authority of the Vedas, but by real, you know, thing that anyone could understand and accept. They proved, yeah, that some 98% of everything everyone did in the pursuit of happiness did not actually bring happiness at all. And then they proved, you know, by that other 2% or whatever of people that were actually doing, you know, attaining happiness, you know, what are the things that actually do bring happiness? And he quoted some of them. One of the main things was activities that are for the welfare, real welfare of other people. Not like what Srila Prabhupada says, you know, bringing one to Krishna, not that kind of welfare, but, you know, like maybe going to Africa and helping people, you know, that are have terrible sickness or, you know, poverty or, you know, go, you know, those kind of things where you're really, really helping and saving someone else who needs, really needs it. You know, they're starving or they're, you know, those type of activities where it's genuinely for the benefit of others bring happiness. And they said certain meditational processes bring happiness. I don't know, they quoted several different things that bring... So he, you know, it was a really interesting thing that he was presenting to these college students, something that one could really, you know, relate to, that practically everything everyone does that they think they're doing to bring happiness to themselves and their family members doesn't result in happiness at all. It results in frustration and addiction and, you know, all kinds of psychological and emotional misery. You know, but something, the things that actually bring happiness are something completely different that most people don't even, aren't even aware of, you know. So, you know, there are different types of happiness. If one comes to the platform of mode of goodness, one automatically feels, you know, happy. And that's important for devotees. It's not that it's not important like we, you know, we think that it's a waste of time because we're after spiritual happiness. You know, of course, we are. We're after spiritual happiness. We're after the happiness that comes from getting the mercy of Krishna and the spiritual master. That's, you know, eternal happiness. That's real happiness, right? But this, you know, happiness on the mode of goodness is also important for devotees. We have to have that, you know, to be able to go the distance. you know, to be able to practice Krishna consciousness for really long periods of time, like most, you know, like we need to do to really attain any, you know, make any advancement. You know, so therefore the different ashrams are recommended. Most people are going to take to the Grihastha ashram because we need a certain amount of happiness and security. And so did I miss anything? Yeah, go ahead.
So second part of the question, what advice can you give us in the devotional community who may not be experiencing the kind of happiness that we either that we thought we would or that we did experience when we did dream?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, truth of the matter is, you know, for real devotees, and I mean, you know, people that are serious about the process of devotional service and actually getting out of this material world, people may be on different levels, newer people, but for devotees who have seriously taken up the process, that unhappiness that they experience is really part of the process, you know. And it's directly given by Lord Krishna. For, you know, materialists, the unhappiness and difficulties that they experience are simply their hopes and dreams being dashed against the concrete. That's all, you know, really what all they, for materialists, you know, and that's why devotees work so hard to try and help others, you know, give them this knowledge, because that's what their lives really amount to, you know, is their hopes and dreams being just dashed against the rocks, you know. But for a devotee, that same happiness and difficulties are his asset. I remember something that Vijay Prabhu was saying in a class not too long ago. He was saying, these difficulties we experience are our friend. He said, and they should not be wasted. You know, what they're meant to lead us to, of course, is to remember Krishna. You know, we know that the real essence of the whole process is to remember Krishna, right? Remember Krishna. Never forget Krishna. And I think maybe some people think, or I know that I thought, at least when I was a younger devotee, that, you know, remembering Krishna was something that would just come about, you know, some point later when I made more advancement. It would just all of a sudden, boom, you know, happen. I'd remember Krishna, you know, because I was Krishna conscious, you know, I was purified. But actually, remembering Krishna has to be practiced. It's sadhana bhakti. And these difficulties are a constant reminder, little knock on the door, you know. Constant reminder, remember Krishna, remember Krishna, remember Krishna. You know, what is Srila Krishna Das Kaviraj say in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that when one is remembering Lord Chaitanya, the most difficult things become easy. And when one is forgetting Lord Chaitanya, the most easy things become extremely difficult, right? So the unhappiness and difficulties are meant to be a reminder. Oh, you forgot Krishna. You remember him. You know, you must rely on him. You must take shelter of him. He's your dearmost friend. There's so many ways to remember Krishna. They're just so wonderful. You know, you can remember him in his deity form. It's the same as remembering him, you know. You can remember him in his form as the spiritual master. It's exactly the same as remembering him. His pastimes, you know, one of the four qualities that only Lord Krishna has, even Lord Narayan doesn't have, is his ocean of wonderful pastimes. Like, you know, his pastimes are compared to waves in the ocean. You know, so many ways to remember Krishna. And when we remember Krishna, what difficulty can't we face? We can face any difficulty if we're really remembering Krishna. You know, I was thinking about it the other day, like, in deity worship, we learn so many verses, you know, become are part of the process of deity worship. And if I think back, all the verses that I learned as a devotee and forgot, yeah, I forgot so many, you know, that I once knew, you know. That's the way the mind is. But some verses, because we quote them regularly, the more we use them and quote them, they really become stuck in the memory. Some verses you never forget because you committed them to memory so much that you'll never forget it, practically, you know. So Krishna consciousness is meant to be like that, that we remember Krishna so much that at the time of death, even the most difficult time, we'll remember Krishna. Because so much, it was put in the mind, put in the mind, put in the heart, put in the heart, you know. Anything else? Or anyone else have any comment, question? Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Kulatanji ki jai, Go Prema Nandi, Hari Hari Bhagavatam.